Can you hear me in the back or no? No. No. Eliyahu, ask Tzvi to take up the mic a little bit. Can you hear me now? No? You speak English? This week's portion is a very depressing portion. People die. A lot of people die. In fact, it could be that more people die in this week's portion than any other portion in the Torah. Do you know why I say that? Who died? Everyone. Which everyone? Aaron dies, Miriam dies, and Moshe gets a death sentence. The whole... The Jews that complain. Yeah? You can challenge anything. Go ahead, challenge. That's what I was thinking of, Egyptians, the flood, whatever, but I'm not sure. The beginning of the portion talks about something called the red heifer, the Parah Aduma. The red heifer is an antidote to death. It's a very strange law. It's a very enigmatic law. In fact, the Torah calls it a chok. A chok means it's a law, and I don't want to confuse you. A chok... There are two types of laws in the Torah. One is called a chok, the other type is called a mishpat. A mishpat is a law. I'll stand up. A mishpat is the type of law that if I would lock each one of you in a room by yourselves and say, come up with 10 laws, the ones that you would come up with by yourselves are called mishpatim. Those are what I think we can call basic moral law. You would all put things like don't murder and don't steal and things like that. Those are mishpatim, those are moral, those all of you understand. Those don't need to be justified. Then there's something else which is called a chok. A chok is a decree. It's the kind of decree that a rationale is not given in the Torah. That doesn't mean it doesn't make sense. All that that means is if I locked each one of you in a room and I told you to make up mishpatim and chukim, no two of you would come up with the same chok. Here, for example, I'll give you a chok in the Torah. I'll give you an example of mishpat and a chok. A mishpat would be don't steal. Okay? Do all of you understand? Do I have to explain to you why not to steal? No. Excellent. I feel safe already. What about if I would say to keep kosher? Keeping kosher makes no sense. Now, you could give me all kinds of explanations for it, but my point is, if you never heard of the law of keeping kosher before, you never heard of the details, you didn't know that milk and meat you can't eat together, you never heard of it, I don't believe any two of you sitting independently would have come up with this wonderful idea, how about this one, let's not eat milk and meat together. That doesn't mean... that after the chok exists, we can't think about it, contemplate, and perhaps even come to understanding of what the symbolism is. Which means you can still be what we used to call in America a Monday morning quarterback and try to figure out what the rationale for a chok is, even though we would not have created it by ourselves. So, for example, with milk and meat, I can say, what is... meat symbolizes. Meat symbolizes death. What does milk symbolize? Milk symbolizes life. Now, the Torah over here is giving us a message and saying milk and meat should not be mixed together. Life and death should not be mixed together. Okay, there's a message involved in that. And it could be that when we keep the laws of kosher, we shouldn't only look at it as blind faith, but we should also try to discern what the symbol is in it. The red heifer, as I said before, is an antidote to death. Why is there death in the world? That wasn't a trick question. Why is there death? Well, that may seem like a strange question. Of course there's death. There's death all over. There's been death since the day of creation. There's always been death. Well, almost since the day of creation. Adam ate from the tree. You disagree?
Well, I was going to say something a bit more about spiritual-wise.
What were you going to say?
So we can learn to live.
Learn to live. That we need negatives in order to have positives. You don't need death then. You just need the threat of death. Mm-hmm. Threats are good enough.
Yeah.
Sir?
And live forever, because then you'd be eternal. There's only one eternity, an eternal being.
No, you wouldn't be eternal, because you'd have a beginning. Thank you. So why is there death? Because Adam and Eve ate from the tree of knowledge, right? So is knowledge good or is knowledge bad?
Neutral. Depends on how you use it.
So forget it, it's a bad question. Because Adam didn't eat from the tree of knowledge. What did he eat from?
Tree of knowledge.
Exactly. You guys have been, what's the word?
Pretty basic.
Yeah, okay. Indoctrinated. Adam and Eve ate from the tree of knowledge and good and evil. And what is the result when you eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil? No, you have complete confusion between what is good and what is evil. That's the problem of the tree. If you lived in a world which was purely good, then you can live forever. You live in a world in confusion where you don't know what is good and what is evil. That causes problems. And God says the day you eat from this tree, death will come into the world. Which means that death is the result of trying to understand that which man could not understand. Eating from the tree of knowledge and good and evil brings death. So therefore, the fact that we find at the beginning of this week's portion a chok, a law that we would not have made up by ourselves, a law that a priori we don't understand, it makes a great deal of sense that that would be the antidote to death. Which means that if you eat from a tree of knowledge of good and evil, death comes into the world. Listening to a law that you don't understand the reason for would be the antidote. There is one step in the middle of this, and that step is something which is alluded to by one of the commentaries by Rashi. Rashi, on the one hand, says that the law of the Parah Aduma, the law of the red heifer, is a chok and you can't understand it, you shouldn't even try to contemplate it. 23 verses later, Rashi comes back and has a retrospective on the beginning of the parsha. And here Rashi says that the reason that you bring the Parah Aduma, the red heifer, is because this serves as an antidote. At this point he doesn't say death, but rather an antidote to the golden calf. And he says, symbolically, let the mother, the red cow, clean up for the golden calf, for its child. And he says it's sort of like if there was a servant in the house of the king and the servant's child made a big mess, then the mother would come in and be asked to clean it up. So the difficult part of Rashi, aside from that whole symbolism, is he just told us in the beginning that you can't understand this law. This is a law without explanation. On the other hand, he tells us that the reason for the law is because something having to do with the golden calf. What happened at the golden calf? The golden calf, the Jews said, the man Moshe is not here. Let's make for ourselves a golden calf, make for ourselves a god who will lead us. According to the Kabbalistic understanding as found in the Zohar, what the people tried to do with the golden calf was to make a god that they can understand. And I want to point something out. Sometimes religion is very frustrating, especially when it comes to dealing with God. We have a problem. On the one hand, part of us, part of our intellect tells us, I don't want to take a leap of faith. I don't want to believe in something I can't understand, because that's absurd. On the other hand, if I can completely understand God, then by definition it's not God. Do you understand what I'm saying? No, you don't understand. We don't have language to describe God. We don't have words. We don't have letters. We don't have prose. We don't have poetry. We do not have the ability, because as you pointed out before, man would be eternal, and right away I said to you, no, man would not be eternal because man has a beginning. We have a great deal of difficulty understanding a being that does not have a beginning nor has an end, or for that matter is not limited by time. You know the famous philosophical question that your collective groups have decided to ask me for the last 20 years because people think it's quite difficult? They say, how can I have free will if God knows the future? Have you ever heard anybody ask that question? Does that sound like a serious question? How can I have free will if God knows the future? So guess what? God doesn't know the future. Why? Because for God, there is no future. For God, there is only a present. For God, past, present, and future is all the same. So if past, present, and future are all the same, please give her a chair. She has a chair? If past, present, and future are all the same, it's not a question of God knowing the future, what you will do. Anybody here know English properly? You know grammar? Tell me if the following sentence works. God knows yesterday what you did tomorrow. In terms of God knows yesterday what you did tomorrow. Okay. So keep saying that over and over to yourself, and at the point where you can understand that that sentence is correct grammatically will be the point that you have the theological enlightenment to understand what I'm trying to say. When you go to university, I want you to use the sentence in a paper, and if the professor marks it with red and tells you your grammar is off, you can then politely tell them that they're theologically challenged. If I say God knew yesterday, then what am I saying? That for God there is such a thing as yesterday. I am trying to make God time neutral. Take God outside of time. Here's the problem. Here's a timeline. Here's the beginning of time. Here's the end of time. Here's every moment of time. Here you are today. Here you are tomorrow and the next day, and here you are yesterday. Where's God? God is up over here. From an identical perspective, saying before there was a creation, after there won't be anything left over here, and every single point in the middle. So God knows yesterday. God knows, because God is always present tense, God knows yesterday what you did tomorrow, because from God's perspective, you already did it. That's what happens when you're outside of time. Do you understand what I just now said? So I know it's very disappointing to solve great theological problems in under 2 minutes. But very often having serious theological problems were based upon having serious theological assumptions or mistaken assumptions. But you understand what I'm saying. I want to go back to my point. My point was that we don't have a language to understand God. I just now gave you an illustration of that. That when I even tried to describe God, you all told me that my grammar was wrong. You get my point now? My grammar wasn't wrong, but it didn't sound right to you. It sounded as if I said something wrong, and I'll go back again. I was just describing something which is a human thing. The first thing that God creates is time. The first thing that God creates is time. Time, space, and matter. What does that then tell you? That God is outside of time and outside of space and outside of matter. Yes? Can you understand that? Not easily. How easy it is for you to imagine a being that exists outside of time, space, and matter? How does a being outside of time, space, and matter create time, space, and matter? The Kabbalistic understanding is by holding back infinity and allowing coexistence, which means that creation is the result of God allowing there to be a coexistence and there to be such a thing called time, space, and matter. But I'm saying all this goes back to my point that even though it's terribly frustrating trying to believe in a God that you cannot see, we're trying to believe in a God that you cannot understand, I think it would be even more frustrating believing in a God that you could see and believing in a God that you could completely understand. Because if you completely understand it, you can completely wrap your mind around it. So what have you just now done? You've just created a God within the human mind. That was part of the problem of the golden calf. But it's very interesting because Moshe is not there. And the people say, Moshe the man, we don't know what happened to him. What's the key word in that sentence? No. So what was their assumption? That they had a right to know. What was their assumption? That man has an inalienable right to understand and to know things. What was the sin in the Garden of Eden? Men tried to eat from the tree of knowledge. What did God say? That will bring death into the world. What happens when man tries to know what happened to Moses? They worship the golden calf. And what did they build instead? They built a god to replace a man. That's crucial. That goes back to whoever said that man was the important word in that sentence. They build a god to replace a man. That god that they built, obviously on many levels there's an absurdity involved in it, but what did they want? What was the deep human desire? To create something that they can relate to. Create a god that you can touch, you can hug, you can pet, you can bow down to. There's something very nice about that, but you're probably better off just getting a dog. And not the beast that my son brought home. If anybody wants a nice dog, then let me know. So we have the golden calf linking the tree of knowledge, taking us all the way to the red heifer. And the red heifer is what? It is what's to be sprinkled on a person who comes in contact with the dead. Accepting a law that we don't understand serves as an antidote. You with me? Accepting a law that we don't understand serves as an antidote for death that comes into the world when man tries to understand that which he can't understand and ends up eating from a tree of knowledge and good and evil, causing there to be confusion between good and evil. And all that's the introduction to this week's portion. So who died? So you know Miriam dies. You know Aaron dies. Who else died?
It foretells that Moshe
dies. So there's one other death, yes. Yes, snake bites are very bad for you, and try to avoid them. Yes, many people die from snake bites. But there's one other group that we missed, and the reason we missed it is because we read through the portion. And if you read through the portion, you don't see it, because it's not there. So who else died? By the way, if you didn't read through the portion, you would have missed it also. Yeah.
Aaron the priest.
Aaron, we said that. Aaron is dead and buried. Who else dies? The whole generation died. The whole generation is gone. The generation that Moses took out of Egypt is no longer there. Which means that it's not just that Aaron dies, and not just that Miriam dies, and not just that Moshe's death is being foretold. Every single family has experienced death. And maybe that's the reason why this week's portion speaks about the antidote to death. Which ironically, or maybe not ironically, in the Jewish tradition sounds as if, and this sounds also like a leap of faith, that somehow faith could transcend death. But then we get to Moshe's, if not his death, but the reason for his death, and we get very disturbed. Because a man like Moshe, a man who has dedicated his entire being for his people, we would like to imagine that either he dies having never done anything wrong, which, by the way, is a fantasy, because everybody sins, or we'd like to imagine the thing that he would have done would have been just such an outrage that therefore God would have said, okay, that's it. And over here, God really gives it to him. The only problem is we don't understand exactly what it was that Moshe did that sounds so horrific. The scene that takes place is a scene that for some reason sounds like we've witnessed these things before. We're told that the entire generation travel on the first day of the month, by the way. Sorry, B'chodesh in the first month. Doesn't tell us which year it is. Should I tell you which year it is? It's the 40th year. 40th year means they're 40 years in the desert, which means all the previous generation have perished. Miriam passes away, and with Miriam's death, there's no more water. And the people come and they gather around Moshe and Aaron and they quarrel with Moshe and they say, let me exact translation over here. If only we had perished as our brothers have perished before God. So it sounds very much like death is on their mind. Why have you brought the congregation of God to the wilderness to die here, we and our animals? And why do you bring us from Egypt to bring us to this evil place, not a place of seed or fig or grape or pomegranate, and there's no water to drink? By the way, what are they lacking? They're lacking water. And now they're referring to all their other complaints. Moshe and Aaron went from the presence of the congregation to the entrance of the tent of meeting and fell on their faces, and the glory of God appeared to them. So far, this sounds like a real frightening beginning, but there's something to look forward to. God appears. I mean, every time we pray, we don't necessarily see God appear. And God spoke to Moshe, saying, "Take the staff and gather together the assembly, you and Aaron, your brother. Speak to the rock before their eyes, and it shall give forth its water. You shall bring forth for them water from the rock and give drink to the assembly and to their animals." Moshe took the staff from before God, as he had commanded him. Moshe and Aaron gathered the congregation before the rock and said to them, "Listen now, O rebels, shall we bring forth water from the rock?" Then Moses raised his arm and struck the rock with his staff twice. Abundant water came forth, and the assembly and their animals drank. So what does this sound like so far? So far, so good. And God said to Moshe and Aaron, "Because you did not believe in me to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you will not bring this congregation to the land that I have given them." So something went wrong, and it's not exactly clear what went wrong. By the way, if you go searching through the commentaries, you will find incredible explanations as to what exactly went wrong. Some say that Moshe was supposed to speak to the rock. By the way, if that's the case, and we're not doubting that that's the case, then why exactly did God say bring the staff? It sounds like a trick. Remember, kids, you played Simon Says? It's as if God didn't say, God said bring the rock, but didn't say hit. And by the way, it's even more complicated, because on a previous occasion, God said bring the staff and hit the rock with the staff. So now he only said bring it and to speak to it. So what went wrong? And by the way, whatever explanation you're going to give, you're going to have a difficulty. Why does Aaron die? What did Aaron do wrong? Shall I review this? God says to Moshe, "Take the staff, speak to the rock." Moshe says to the people, I'll say the exact thing, "You rebellious people, shall we bring forth water from this rock?" Raised his hand and hit the rock. So it could be hitting the rock. It could be getting angry. It could be calling the people rebels. What did Aaron do wrong? It could be that Aaron's job was to speak and Aaron doesn't speak, and that's the problem. But I'm just telling you, you can keep on going on and on and on, and you're going to find that despite all kinds of explanations, it's not so simple. Yeah. That would be a fair suggestion, although God says, "Because you did not believe in me," I'll read the Hebrew. "Because you didn't believe in me to sanctify me in front of the eyes of the community of the children of Israel, therefore you will not bring these people in." So it's a little difficult to say that it's just timing. God says, "Oh yeah, by the way, no." And by the way, is that frightening? If Moses is accused of not believing in God, what does that do for the rest of us? May as well just pack it in right now and order out from McDonald's, right? So not so quick. Hold the order. Yeah?
Just going back to that point before, it says, kind of intriguing that it said Moses hit the rock two times.
Mm-hmm.
So in life, you're never really guilty for the first thing.
Yeah.
They cannot look at you guilty of looking at what you shouldn't look. You're guilty for not looking away or looking the second time. So Aaron standing right by him, as he usually does, lends support to that.
Yeah, there are commentaries who claim that it's hitting the second time, which is the problem. He could have just hit it once. But even the way that you explained it, it sounds like the first time is wrong also, but it only gets punished for the second time. And what? And look, I like the direction you're going in, is that Aaron is guilty for not doing something because it's very hard to accuse him of doing something because he didn't do anything.
Does it have anything to do with the fact that he mentioned God's bringing the water? I don't know.
That's a real good suggestion. Is that they should have somehow brought God into this.
Yeah, he kind of just said, like, you rebellious people, here's your water. And it's like God had no part in it.
Very good. Very good. Yeah.
Yeah, it seemed like he was kind of taking the leadership away from God and kind of putting the leadership in his hands.
Mm-hmm.
He was saying, you know, shall I perform this miracle and bring you water from
right.
the rock instead of Hashem will provide water for you. So it seems like
he took
the power of God's hands.
Okay, very good. You guys are focused. Let's go back, and instead of looking at this as a micro issue, let's spread it out a little bit as a macro issue. There are two elements here. There's speech and there's physical force. Speech, as far as Judaism is concerned, is the defining element of the human being. Remember I said before, man doesn't have the language, the words, the letters to speak about God? But we have the ability to speak. And it's perhaps speech that makes us different from the animal kingdom. I don't know if animals can communicate. I suspect they can. They can make noises. They can make themselves known. But they can't speak as such. Speech is actually how God creates the world. God says, let there be light. And that may seem very simple to you. But God could create by snapping an anthropomorphic finger. God could will the world into creation. Why is it necessary that the world's created by speech? And therefore, speech is something which is perhaps the highest level of human ability. There's much to speak about in terms of speech, but it is very interesting that when it comes to speech, Moses, we're told, is actually lacking in speech. And it goes back again to the role of Aaron. Moses, when he complains that I can't speak, God says, Aaron is there to speak for you. So I can then continue and then perhaps theorize that it's because Aaron doesn't speak is maybe part of the problem over here. But let's continue. Physical force and speech are two different realms. Where do we see this perhaps more than any other place? Yeah. Excellent. When Jacob dresses up as Esav and goes into his father to get a blessing, what does his father say to him? He says to him, the voice is the voice of Jacob and the hands are the hands of Esav. So what does that then lead me to a conclusion? That the realm of speech, the realm of prayer, the realm of study of Torah is the realm of Jacob. The realm of the hand, the realm of force, the realm of the sword is the realm of Esav. Now let me ask you a question, and this is not an easy question, and it will be particularly difficult if you went to yeshiva. If you didn't, then all bets are off and you have a chance. When Isaac says the famous line, Hakol kol Yaakov yadayim yidei Esav, the hands are the hands of Jacob. Sorry, the voice is the voice of Jacob and the hands are the hands of Esav. How does he end the sentence? Period, question mark, exclamation point. I gave you three choices. Is he questioning? And by the way, see, that's the thing. When you study in yeshiva as a kid, that's what they tell you. They tell you it's a question mark because he's confused. What's going on over here? Is this Yaakov or is it Esav? I have conflicting information. So let's just play that out a little bit more. Can you picture somebody who's on their deathbed and about to give the most important possession that they have to someone, but they're not sure who that someone is? Would they proceed if they had a question? Or would they stop right there? Isaac is afraid he's going to die. Isaac wants to give over, as far as he's concerned, the most valuable thing that he has. What is this? What is it? It's not just the blessing of the fruit. It's much more than that. What is this blessing? What is the blessing? What is the blessing? The blessing is the blessing of Abraham. It's the blessing of who will receive the land of Israel. You know what else comes in the blessing?
Nation.
To become the Jewish nation. You know what else is in the blessing? That you get to fulfill the covenant that God made with Abraham. What was in that covenant? You will be slaves for 400 years. You'll be slaves in a land which isn't yours. By the way, Esav didn't want this blessing so much. In this week's portion, when the Jews come out of Egypt and they're on the way to the land of Israel and they're about to get to the property of Edom, the people of Esav, they say to them, "This is your brother Israel. We went down into slavery. We were slaves and we prayed to God and God took us out. And now we're here. We're about to go back to the land of Israel." And what does Edom come and say? What are the Jews asking? "Can we go through your land and head back to the land of Israel?" And what do they say? "Come near us. We will kill you with a sword." Isn't that so Esav-like? "We will take a sword. We will kill you with a sword." It's interesting. But do you realize what happened in Egypt? The Jews fulfilled the covenant with God. How did they fulfill it? They merged two things together. They were slaves. How are you slaves? By working with your hands. And what did they then do? Then they cried to God in prayer. Which means the slavery of Egypt somehow merges together these two elements. When the Jews leave Egypt and they're on the way to Mount Sinai, somebody comes to attack them. Who's that? Amalek. Who is Amalek? The great-grandson of Esav. Amalek comes with the sword, attacks him with the sword. What does Moshe do when the Jews are attacked? And what does he do? At the moment that Moshe prays, his hands are up in the air. Moshe lifts his hands. So what's he now doing at this moment? He's merging together the physical and the spiritual. He's merging together the prayer, the voice of Jacob, and the hands of Esav, which lead me back to the point. When Yitzchak says this, "Hakol kol Yaakov yidayim yidei Esav," it is the voice of Jacob in the hands of Esav. Does he say this with an exclamation point or a question mark? If it's a question mark, he should have stopped right then. Instead, what does he do? He gives the blessing. And by the way, do you know why he gave the blessing? He most likely believed that Esav found his voice instead of believing that Yaakov found his hands. What's easier to do? Is it easier to take a yeshiva bacher and teach him to be tough? Or easier taking somebody who's tough and teach him spirituality? I think that Yitzchak thought it would be easier the other way around. I think he was quite surprised when he figured out that it was really Yaakov who somehow found his inner Esav rather than Esav finding his inner Yaakov. But what does he want to try to do to get to a merger between the two? So at that moment, when Moshe's on the mountain, merging prayer and his hands. But I want to focus it. What's he doing with his hands? He's using his hands to pray. It's at that moment that the Jews are able to defeat the descendants of Esav. Do you all see that? Now, all these years later, the people need water. And God says, take the stick, and I'll add one word in, but speak to the rock. At this point, what does Moshe do? He speaks and he hits the rock. So hitting the rock is using force. You, by the way, all of you would be very impressive if any of us can take a stick and hit a rock and water comes out. That's very impressive. For Moshe, it's less impressive. Matter of fact, Moshe's entire life has been revolving around rocks and water. Right? Moshe is born and he's put in the water. When he holds up his hands, he has two rocks holding up his hands. He goes up to Mount Sinai, he brings rocks down, written with the word of God. Moshe gets to the water, The sea gets split. The water and rocks are two themes that are weaved completely through the story of Moshe's life. And now Moshe is standing, and I'm telling you what the challenge is going to be to somehow replicate that battle against Amalek, to be able to merge together the spiritual and the physical in the sense that the words and the hands go together. And God says, take the staff, but speak to the rock. It sounds like he is supposed to take the staff, but not hit it. Not to show force. Not to do it with brute strength. But rather, what he's supposed to do is somehow speak in prayer. Does he speak in prayer? No. Instead, what's his speech? His speech is to the people. Back there on the mountain, he prays to God, and that brings victory. At this point, instead of praying, what is Moshe doing? He's telling the people, you rebellious people. By the way, do any of us blame Moshe? Do you know why he calls them rebellious people? Because they were rebellious people. They're complaining about the food. Do you realize for 40 years, the Torah tells us that they had food coming down from heaven every day. And what are they complaining? They're complaining, yeah, but we don't have the food in Egypt. You know, excuse me. God is providing them everything for 40 years, and they're complaining about the food. Yes?
You don't think this was a valid complaint? They were obviously the children, the children of the actual Jews who were brought out of Mitzrayim, which means it's very likely they grew up in the desert. Most of them were probably born in the desert.
Beautiful.
They have no food to compare the man to. The man tastes
beautiful. 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 But do you realize what they're saying?
Well, they're
saying, why'd you just take us out of Egypt where the food was so great? Which means that the only thing that they got from their parents, because they weren't in Egypt, so what did they get from their parents? They inherited the complaint. They inherited how great the food used to be in Egypt. Yeah. What about inheriting how great it was when the sea got split? What about inheriting how great it was when the heavens opened up? Which means within their complaints, you can be deluded into thinking that this was the generation left Egypt. They weren't. And that's what's scary. I understand your point. It's a very sharp point that you made. They had nothing to compare it to, so therefore they couldn't make the food any better. But still, they have food coming from God, but that's not good enough. And they're complaining, why do you take us out of Egypt? Excuse me? You were slaves in Egypt. You were tortured in Egypt. But it could be that this is taking us to another point. Now let's go back to what I just now said. Why does Moshe call them a rebellious people? Yes? Because they were a rebellious people. The question is, how do you treat people that are rebellious? So one way to treat them is to turn to them and say, you guys are a bunch of losers. What's another way of doing it? Is taking them and somehow lifting them up and taking them to another level. But there's a much deeper issue here that we need to understand. One of the great commentaries from the 19th century, his name was Rabbi Meir Simcha from Dvinsk, from the city of Dvinsk. He died around 1924. He actually wrote this commentary before the age of 20. Actually, before the age of 19, he wrote it. And it was never published in his lifetime. After he died, they found it. His father told him not to publish it. Long story, not for now. His commentary is called the Meshech Chachma. And nobody knows it, unless they read my book. But they don't know it because he didn't say it on this verse. He said it much later on in the book of Deuteronomy. In the book of Deuteronomy, Moshe says something which sounds quite strange. He says, God took you out of Egypt and brought you to this land. And then he says, V'Hashem hit anaf bi al divrechem. And God got upset with me because of you. V'yishva levulti avriyat ha'yarden. And God therefore swore that I would not cross the Jordan. Moshe over here is blaming his death on the people. He says, because of you, I can't go in. Now, does that seem right in terms of what we just now read? Now, it could be that Moshe is saying, because you kept on bothering me, I guess this would be the normative approach, because you kept on bothering me, I finally said, you know, you rebellious people, or I finally got mad, or whatever explanation you want to give, you caused me to do this. But you know what? That's a little disappointing. We wouldn't want Moshe to be blaming them if it's really his fault. Take responsibility. So the Meshech Chachma says, the death of Moshe, and what I'm about to tell you, is very, very frightening. And let me just preface it by saying, in life, we like to make excuses. This is not the first time I'm saying what I'm about to say. And if you ever heard me say it, listen to me again and think about this. When we die and we go up to heaven and God challenges us and says, why didn't you accomplish so on and so forth? You know what we're going to do? We're going to make excuses. One of your excuses is going to be that you didn't have good enough rabbis. Right? You're going to blame me. Thank you. You're going to go up to God and say, what do you want from me? My rabbis were losers. If my rabbis would have been better, if my parents would have been better, if my teachers would have been better, if this would have been, we will blame everybody around us except for ourselves and take responsibility. Which leads us to an excellent question. Then why doesn't God give us better rabbis? Why doesn't God give us better leaders? Why are we stuck the way that we are? And the very frightening answer is that we get what we deserve. The Meshech Chachma says, the generation where Moshe was born, the generation that the people remember his mother and his father and his mother being pregnant and his mother having morning sickness and Moshe in diapers and so on and so forth, that generation saw Moshe in one way. What about the new generation who never saw Moshe as a kid? They only heard the legends about Moshe. They see Moshe in a completely different way. He says that Moshe cannot go into the land of Israel because Moshe is on too high of a level. Somebody said it before. A couple of you caught the point, which I think is the crucial point here. When Moshe hits the rock, what does he say? And now God will give you water? Or now he says, and now we? By saying that, he strengthened the perception of the people that it's Moshe who's doing this. Here, let me give you a parallel point. When Moshe comes down from the mountain, just, and this will also tie things together from everything we've seen today. When Moshe comes down from the mountain, what does he see the people doing? Worshipping the golden calf. What's in his hands? Two rocks, the Ten Commandments. What does he do with them? Throws them to the ground. Why? So before you give me any answer, let me tell you what the Meshech Chachma says, and he's consistent. He says if the Jewish people can worship a golden calf, something which they made themselves with their hands, then they would certainly one day worship the Ten Commandments, which was made from the hands of God. Is that when he sees the people worshiping something which is physical, then he says they cannot have the Ten Commandments. And by the way, what's the difference between the first Ten Commandments and the second ones? The first one God himself made, and the second one Moshe makes, which seems to support what I think is a brilliant observation, is that we couldn't have the real Ten Commandments. You know why? Because they were too holy. And we couldn't handle such holiness. That's scary. Ever hear this idea that we don't know where Moshe's buried? Why not? What does it say? Why don't we know where Moshe's buried? Yes?
So that people don't worship
him. So the people don't pray there. Rashi explains, as you said, because they'll end up turning it into some kind of idolatry, which, by the way, is not that different from what I'm about to say. The Maharal says something which is even more frightening. He doesn't say anything about idolatry. He says because people would pray there. Know what would happen? Know what would happen by Moshe's grave? Every prayer would come true. You guys think you're ready to pray? You think you know what to pray for? You know the first thing you'd have to pray for? It's like the same thing if a genie says you have three wishes. What's the first thing you ask for? Three more wishes, right? Because the first thing you'd pray for, if you're going to pray by Moshe's grave and every prayer comes true, the first thing you better pray for is to have insight to know what to pray for. But how many people would say, may that girl fall in love with me? And not realizing that you just cursed yourself for this world and the next. How many people would pray to have more money than they know what to do with and realize they just destroyed their lives? How many people would really know? Would you really want that ability? I know somebody whose mother said to his father, in the last conversation they ever had, drop dead, and he did 15 minutes later. How do you think she felt the rest of her life? Do you want that power? But if we'll go away from the Maharal and go back to the normative approach, we can't even have Moshe, we can't even have Moshe's grave because it's too holy. We can't have the Ten Commandments because it's too holy. We can't have Moshe as a leader taking us into the land of Israel because Moshe is too holy. Moshe contributed to this when Moshe says, we will give you water. What should Moshe have done at that point? Follow exactly what God did, what God says. He should have taken his staff. He should have used his words. The words should not have been focused towards the people. The words should have been focused towards God. If he would have, again, as he did by fighting Amalek, lifted his hands in prayer, take the staff, and lifted heavenwards, pointing towards God with the staff. Had he said to God, God, please give these people water, then the people would have understood that the water came from God. At that moment, Moshe would have sanctified God's name. But instead, Moshe's sin, and it's ever so subtle, Moshe's sin is giving the impression that the water came from him. And it's frightening, because you know what? When he hits the rock, what happens? It works. Moshe has that power. It works. But the reason we can't have Moshe is because Moshe's too holy for us. And what happens instead? You get stuck with rabbis on your level. And don't make excuses. Because if you want better rabbis, you got to pick yourselves up to a higher level. I know you think it's the other way around. But you got to pick yourselves up to a higher level, and then you make your rabbis better. We don't like our prime minister. We have to pick up the level, and we make the country better. We don't like the leadership, and there's nothing more popular today than to complain about leadership. We don't like the leadership. We become better people, we'll make the leadership that much better. But when the expectations are down, the leadership is down, the rabbis are down, the teachers are down, and then you know what happens? You have wonderful excuses when you get up to heaven. And God's going to ask you what went wrong, and you're going to point the finger in every other direction. And when God explains, it's because of the generation. It's because of you. And that excuse goes away. That's very frightening. So let's save the middleman. Let's save all the difficulties. Let's save the explanations. And let's become a people that deserve much better leaders. Have a good Shabbos.